Hello. My name is Matt and I'm an addict. Hi. I'm also your convention chair. CA Spain would like to welcome you all. We have worked very hard over the last year to put together an event we hope you will all enjoy. A few things to take note of. Banquet tickets are on sale at registration desk and are in limited supply. Lanyards must be worn at all times. The clean time countdown will happen directly after the closing speaker on Sunday. The convention committee thank you for attending and allowing us all to be of service. Most important is the convention statement of anonymity. Anonymity is one of the most important issues in the structure of Cocaine Anonymous. Therefore, in observance of the 11th edition of Cocaine Anonymous, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, television and films. We earnestly request that those gathered here honour this condition of anonymity. In keeping with our traditions, we request that no photographic or video recording of the convention be distributed, published or downloaded in any general public forum, including the internet and or any other electronic communications network. We specifically request that members refrain from posting on any social networking site any convention photos or videos which identify any activity, entity or person as being associated with Cocaine Anonymous. If you should happen to recognise someone who here identifies themselves as an addict, please keep that knowledge strictly to yourself. So now I will invite Will to introduce our opening speaker.
Hi everyone, my name's Will, I'm an addict. I wasn't going to get involved in the convention this year, simply for the fact that I really suffer on committees. And so when the committee started to form about a year ago, I made a decision that I wasn't going to get involved. Anyway, the guy who was doing the speakers had to move back to the UK. So I was asked to get the speakers and to join the committee. So that was my task for the last year. So I've done that, and I hope everybody enjoys what they hear over the weekend. But what I did do is I chose speakers who I knew and who were my friends, but also have been part of my journey in this time that I've been consistently clean. And one of those was Matt, and I met Matt in 2011. He rang the helpline because he was on holiday here. This is one of the wonderful things about Cocaine Anonymous Spain that lit me up and that has introduced me to fellowship all over the world, was that people call the helpline to ask about meetings, and Matt called the helpline to ask about meetings, but he also called to ask if he could share his inventory with me every day. So I was like, yeah, and that was the first time I'd done that. I hadn't been through some the work that we do here, and I certainly wasn't writing any inventory. And I was in a terrible place in my recovery at that time. So Matt sort of carried a message to me with that. He'd ring me up in the morning, and he'd share his inventory. He'd share the solution, and I'd share the problem. And that went on for about a good week. And Matt kept saying, you know, have you written about it? I'd be like, why am I going to do it? Because I didn't know. And then we stayed in touch. And what happens a lot for me in this fellowship is that everything's connected. And years later, I became friends with someone else who was friends with Matt. And in America, they have a thing called Fellowship of the Spirit, an event that goes on. And this has been, for me, with getting the speakers this time, has been aligned with that, with the fellowship in my spirit, which I've met as a result of recovering here in Spain and meeting lots of wonderful people who are doing the deal and carry the message and live the programme, not just talk about it. So no pressure, Matt. But I'd like to introduce Matt for our opening speaker tonight.
Good evening, my name's Matt and I'm an alcoholic. Feels good to be here, but that's a lie. It doesn't actually feel good to be here. But what I've found out over the last 7 years is what actually sometimes feels good isn't actually good, and sometimes what actually bad isn't actually bad, it's good, you know. And the book tells us we must outgrow our fears, you know. We must face our most ruthless creditors, you know, and fear is a big one, you know. Self-reliance is fear, and if I mean self-reliance, I mean agnosticism, And if I'm in agnosticism, there is no God. So I've asked him to remove my fear and direct my attention to what he would have me be. You know, and the book says at once we commence to outgrow fear. I'd like to thank Will and the committee for asking me. It is a pleasure. It is an honour. As I said, it doesn't feel like it, but I also know that something happens around a certain point when I'll start talking about certain things and fear will leave the building. You know, Will was speaking about when I first met him, and it was funny, me and Kieran, we hit the road this morning. I picked up Alex at about 2 o'clock, drove down for Kieran in Brentwood, and hit the plane, and we got here and we landed. And I was talking to Kieran, and Kieran said, "What are you going to talk about?" I said, "I don't know, I don't know what I'm going to talk about." He said, "Why don't you talk about what you were talking to me about how sexy that Dr. Foster is on the television?" And that's where I was at. Obviously, I can't, you know, talk about that stuff. But it was funny. I sort of had one of them moments when I got off the plane. We went and got a bus ticket, me and Kieran. And to the left of me, there's this big, giant Cruise Campo sign. And to the right of me, there's a tapas bar. And over here, you know, the Spanish, they know how to do it proper. You know, we have dirty old spit and sawdust pubs and boozers. And over here, it's nice. You know, it's relaxed, it's, you know, sociable, you know, cosmopolitan. And I can remember being 42 days sober and coming off a plane from London to this point, and I was just there in that point, 42 days sober. And what happened, that was in 2010, what happened was I'd gone to Spain, I'd gone through the steps very, very quickly, and it was advised I didn't go, but the wife said we've got to go, and we got out of this baggage and we pulled them in, and all of a sudden the San Miguel signs are all lighting up, the Cruise Campo's going drink me, drink me, drink me, and I'm looking, and the wife says to me the things what you should never say to an alcoholic. Seems my wife's got a strange mental blank spot of 43 days fucking previous. She said to me, "I don't mind if you have a drink while you're on holiday, as long as when you get back on board." You know, and I can remember getting on the coach, going to a place called Nurha, and there's a fellow who's in the rooms, I think he's over here, I can't see him, where he's here now, but he had a sister who lived in Nurha, who was 20 years plus in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got on that bus, and I held on for dear life. And I prayed and I prayed and I prayed. And I got off the bus, and there was this hotel was here. So the back door's where that is. There was the most beautiful big white church. I run straight into this beautiful big white church, hit my knees, I prayed, I asked for it to be removed. I came out, I found this man's sister, and she said to me, "If you turn around now," and I swear with my hand on my heart, no more than 100 metres up the road was a little tiny room where they had Spanish Alcoholics Anonymous meetings 5 days a week. And I have not drunk since 43 days previous to that. And that's all due to a power what entered into my life on the 22nd of June 2010. What said, enough is enough. You know, I'm not no sort of what it was like, wishy-washy, soft sell it. I hit something what was not bottom. You know, I hear a lot of people speaking about rock bottoms. For me, there is no such fucking thing as a rock bottom. If I'd had a rock bottom, you'd have a different speaker stood up here tonight. Because a rock bottom is death, you know, funerals, burnt, cremated, everything. And it's also a trap what's been laid to me by my ego. Because once I've hit that bottom, and then the ego's built me back up, dusted me back off, and then I got back on that downward spiral yet again and again. And that was what had happened. And on the 22nd of June 2010, something said to me, enough is enough. You can't keep doing this no more. You know, and what happened was, you know, I was a very, very inward boy to myself, to my parents, but as anybody who knows me, I can be very outward in a crowd. you know, work in the road construction game. My dad's in the road construction game. His dad was in the road construction game. We're all from a big, rough council estate up in Manchester. And you know what? I thought my life was mapped out for me. And you know what? Still now today, my map is mapped out for me. But it depends who's driving the vehicle on the map. Is it Matt Self who run riot? Or is it the great God who removed this mental obsession to drink and use cocaine and do lots of other sordid and dirty, horrible things? And what path I choose is this path, what I'm doing here. So when Will asks me to come here, it's a no-brainer. I will go anywhere where Cocaine Anonymous will send me. It sends me to a crack house, I'll go to a crack house. It sends me back up to Manchester to speak, I'll go to Manchester to speak. Will ask me to come here, I'll come here. For you, I'll be ever indebted in my life. You know, because you give me something. You give me something what nobody else had ever given me. You give me hope. You give me faith, and you give me courage. You know, and I came from this family, this loving family. You know, and all I could ever think, you know, I was different and strange in a family where I never needed to be different and strange. You know, and the things I put my mother and father through. You know, my mother and father was 19 years old when she got pregnant with me. And given a sufficiently good enough reason, my dad get my mum pregnant, they made it work. And they stuck together through thick and thin for me. And then along came my sister. You know, my mum and dad, you know, to our American friends won't know this, they're a bit like Jack and Vera off of Coronation Street. God bless her, she passed away the other day. You know, they'll argue and fight like cat and dog, but they'll always be there. And all I ever used to do was throw it back in their face. Time and time again. Mother holding my hand, taking me up to the doctors, making sure I get my Librium, detoxing me in the house. This woman, proud little woman, who at 19 years of age put her life on hold for me. And all I can do is play the blame game. It's all your fault. Because you love my sister more than me. Because you sent my sister to private school. My inventory showed me that wasn't true. My inventory actually showed me it was because I was a bit of a div. That was the reason I never went to private school. But it shows you the levels of how powerful this shit is, what we've got going on inside. Because all it wants to do is fix and put the blame on something outside. You know, this ego is designed to trip you and say, it ain't me, it's him. It ain't me, it's her. If only she hadn't left me. And I went through this cycle of different women, different jobs, playing the blame game. You know, the book talks about the blame thrower. That was me. You know, and I thought, I'd always get through. Always get through. You know, I always worked for my father. I worked for him in the road construction. I run a couple of gangs for him. And, you know, I worked with, like, Irish gypsies and Romani gypsies and Scousers and, you know, proper wrong-uns, Docker-type people. Do you know what I mean? Spitting sawdust, tooting in the van. Do you know what I mean? Drinking cider in the morning, smoking joints and bongs first thing. These were my heroes, these were my idols, these were my people. You know, and my life was mapped out for me. I had a lovely little bird, a little too weak for me, who I could just do whatever I wanted to. When I said I was out, I was out. And she'd follow me around all the pubs and clubs in Manchester, and she just couldn't hold me down. And it just shows you when you think that you're in charge of something and you're in this plan, when really you've got no idea what's in the plan and what's in the pipeline and what's coming down the pipeline. You know, I've got firm affirmation with Spain. You know, I had my first ever ecstasy tablet in Spain, in Amnesia, in 1992. Carried on to go to the Hacienda. You know, proper spiritual experiences, not of the spiritual kind, of the MDMA kind, but that was what it was like. But I can always remember this girl, Rachel, had seen me go through ecstasy-induced psychosis. She used to hold my hand when I couldn't get out of bed, crippled with panic attacks, and all I can do is pour alcohol on panic attacks, smoke skunk on panic attacks, you know, and I'm just dying from the inside out. And what happened was, I went through this cycle for about 4 years, and for about 4 years, Bill talks about fear sobered him for a while. I didn't take an ecstasy tablet for about 3 years, because one day I took a moody one, next thing I know I'm on a fucking stretcher, in the back of an ambulance, everything's going on wrong, mum and dad are in there, I think I'm dying, and they're holding my hand, and it scared me enough not to take it, but that's when the drink took to another level. And what happened was, obviously the ego rebuilt itself, if sufficiently enough to tell me it's alright. And it was a boys' holiday, going on to a BFA, and some of the lads said, "Do you fancy coming to a BFA?" And it was just, yeah, no problem. And I can remember this girl, Rachel, I've been with her for 6 years, and we was there, and she dropped me off at Manchester Ringway, it's Manchester Piccadilly now, and I can remember giving the girl a kiss, and I said, "When I get back, me and you'll get a little place together." And a little face filled up with tears, and she was so happy. And I remember getting on that plane, we took off, double dropped a couple of E's as soon as we was on there. You know, 4 years of psychosis was not in my mind. You know, nothing. Gets off there, gets back to the room, quarter of cocaine each, pills are out, bottles of vodka, bottles of champagne, straight out, straight to space, party, party. And on the third or fourth night, we was in Pasha in Ibiza, which is a proper club. And we was there, and we was bopping away, and I'll never forget, we was in there, it was the night after France had won the World Cup, and one of their star players was a fella called Yuri Djorkaeff, and he played in the final, and he's dancing on the dance floor, and he's proper having it, and he's proper getting down, and I'm going over to him saying, "Oh, you've got signed for United," and all that old bollocks, and I'm there, and all my mates have pulled all these birds, and all of a sudden I get this like little tap on my shoulder, and I turns round, and there's this tiny lady, and she says, "Excuse me, mate, do you know anybody in here who's getting any pills?" And I'm like, "Yeah, of course I'm, sweetheart, I've got about 20 head on me." And that girl is my wife today. What a fucking storyline that is for me two sons' birthdays when they're 21 and 18. "Well, how did you meet your mother?" Well, funnily enough, you know, and I can really identify with Bill Wilson. He talks about a whirlwind romance occurred, you know, with him and Lois. And that's what happened. You know, I stuck like glue to this girl for the remainder of the holiday. I got back from the holiday, jogged Rachel on, the girl was absolutely heartbroken. And within about 3 weeks, we're going back and forward to London every single week. And she fixed something inside of me, which I never thought could have been fixed at that time. A human power had touched me so deep, and I was absolutely besotted, obsessed with this beautiful half Italian girl. You know, she did for me something what no other female had ever done. You know, my eyes would never wander or ever stray or ever look at anything else. I was totally, totally besotted with her. You know, I can remember, we'd go and stay at her place in London. We'd drink, we'd use all weekend, it was great, do what we do. And I can remember, I used to get back on the train at London Euston. And at London Euston, I'd have to lock myself in the buffer sort of thing where the toilet is, and I'd sob till we got to Watford. And there was a reason why I used to sob till I got to Watford, because that was when the bar fucking opened in the train. But that was the sort of power this girl had on me. You know, she had something on me what nobody else had done before. And what happened was, after about a year, she said, "This is getting a bit silly, this. So do you want to come move down with me?" So I come down, and I moved down in 1999. And I moved down, and then all of a sudden, you know, the old baby straps, you know, the reins was off. There was no mother to rein me in when I was pissing the bed and being sick and throwing up and doing what I was doing. There was no uncles to come round and say, I've heard what you've been doing fighting again. I've heard who you've hit with the bouncers. There was nobody there. There was just me in London and loneliness like I'd never ever known before. You know, and I found cocaine and alcohol, which took me to a new level. And within 6 months of being in London, this beautiful, beautiful half-Italian girl, who I used to call sweetheart and treacle and darling, who was my everything, she soon had a new name. And that wasn't treacle and sweetheart and beautiful. It was a word I won't mention in front of females. And I used to call her that on a daily basis. And I'd sit there and I'd terrorise this girl. Absolutely terrorise her. And for some crazy reason, she married me. You know, the wedding was absolutely fucking horrendous. You know, come 7:30, 8:30, I'm asking the bloke at the bar, has he got any gear? I'm puking up all over my suit. And it was just an absolute nightmare. And from that point, my mother disowned me. She just couldn't look at me. They'd all come down from Manchester. They was all there, all the family, all my friends, and it was the loneliest I've ever felt in my life. And I felt pain like I'd never known. And you know what he said? Fuck 'em. We'll show them. We'll do what we'll do. And my drinking and using spiralled out of control. You know, come Christmas, it's a regular thing, bit of Librium, detox here, antidepressants, Valium. And my mother dragging me to the doctor's Christmas Eve. I'd spent something like £1,700 and I ended up at my mother's front door 6 months after not speaking to her. Let me in, I'm dying. This proud woman, 19 years old, a big son who she absolutely worships, 6'5". She's that big, my mum. And I'm shaking and I'm rattling and I'm throwing up blood on the doorstep. Christmas Eve, 2001. And she took me to the doctors and they wanted to put me away and she wouldn't have them put me away. And he gave me these Libriums and he said, if he drinks on these, there is a very, very strong chance he will die. You know, for 3 or 4 days, it's like a scene from Trainspotting and everything's going on. With a firm resolution, I'm not drinking, I'm not going back to that bitch. That's a definite, because it's all her fault. She made me this way. I wasn't like this. And of course, my mum's, yeah, she is. She was like this. She was never like this when he was up here. No. Mental blank spot when I've got my father up against the wall by the throat. You know, doesn't remember that stuff. Because all my mother wants to do is protect me. All my mother wants to do is save me. All my mother wants to do is hold me and keep me there and look after me. And after about 3 days, I've got to go home. Lisa's on the phone crying. No children involved at this time. It's our first year of marriage. And you're up there going into a detox over Christmas. And I got on the train at Manchester Piccadilly and my mum was sobbing. Promise me you're going to this detox. Promise me you'll go to Alcoholics Anonymous. And with every single fibre in my heart, I meant it and I promised I'd go and do that. And she gave me these Libriums. And I got on the train at Manchester Piccadilly, 4 days away from a drink. And I got on the train and what happened was, I got to Manchester Piccadilly, got on the train, I remember getting myself a cup of tea. More about alcoholism stuff, this. Got myself a cup of tea and a Kit Kat. Drank the cup of tea and a Kit Kat. This is at Stockport. By the time I've got to Stoke-on-Trent, there's 2 empty cans of Foster's on the table from me. And I've got no idea where the empty cans of Foster's came from. You know, the book talks about a strange mental blank spot. Cans of Foster's. I would have given my 2 sons cans of Foster's. It's like piss. But I don't know about this allergy, what's inside of me. What has now been triggered off. I'm going back, meant to be with my tail in between my legs, to the girl who's at home, whose mum and dad have had to comfort her all over Christmas. And I go in, knocking on the door another 3 days later, get in bed with her and expect to have a rollabout. Because that is how delusional my thinking is. You know, Christmas 2001, the year Matt ruined Christmas, part one. Now, I could go on, there's an old fucking trilogy of this stuff. There's prequels, sequels, ones he'd not made yet, like the Star Wars themes. But this is what it was. Do you know, when I'm off, and I'm up and running, and I'm going to AA then, you know, and bless them, them men. you know, I got 12 steps, I'll never forget, there was a fella knocks on the door, and, you know, he obviously wasn't like me. You know, and he took me to a meeting, and he did the chair, and he spoke about how he was drunk driving, and, you know, and he said to me, I'll never forget, he said, you don't need to worry about that big book, or any of that stuff. Don't worry about all that what's on the walls. Just go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Keep quiet, and everything will be all right. I think I lasted about 3 or 4 days. Then after that, I crossed the other line, what I said I'd never cross. The line what I'd never seen my father do to my mother, with all the Jack and Vera incidents, you know. And I did that unthinkable act to my beautiful little Italian wife, and she caught for one, an uppercut. 6'5" and 22 fucking stone, and she stood there 9 stone piss wet through, because she scratched me down my face. But the reason why she scratched me down my face is because I've been calling them horrible fucking deplorable names, because I want to vent all this venom and all this anger out, you know, and I just can't see a way out, you know. And this girl kept on taking me back and taking me back and taking me to see that, and we went to, I think I did 70 meetings in 70 days in AA, you know, telling me to think. I now know I can't think my way out of a fucking mental obsession. If I could just think, I wouldn't be stood here on this podium telling you what I've done. Do you know what I mean? You know, live and let live. I can't look at myself in the mirror. Take it easy. Take what fucking easy? Do you know what I mean? First things first, I can't stop drinking. You know, there's not one of them men meant to be 20, 30 years of sobriety in their meetings saying, yeah, son, get that book, get round my house, and I'll take you through that programme. Not a fucking one of them. All they're giving me is the information of 1990, keep your mouth shut and everything will be alright, and if you want a drink, pick the phone up and then give me a phone call. Them men was not like me, and I went round that cycle for years until that happened on the 22nd of June 2010. You know, my mum said, everything will be alright, you'll change when the boys are born, when the kids was born, but obviously didn't know there was boys at the time, you'll change when the kids are born, you know, it'll be the making of you. Guess what, it got fucking worse. She was there in labour, my girl, for 30 odd hours, and all I can do is, I'm just going out and need a bit of fresh air, off you round the corner, I'm just gone. She's there, can't get nothing off the gas and oxygen, I'm like that, and just drinking and drinking and drinking. She sat there for 30 odd hours in labour, and I sat there and must have drunk 12 cans of lager in front of her while she's doing it. And all I can see is this big African nurse just looking at me going, like that. Just absolutely disgusted. Absolutely repulsed. And I don't want to do this, but I ain't got the power not to do this. We go back, then the next boy comes, little Luke. You know, and I can remember, she went 2 weeks over again, and I can never forget, she's home going to bed now, and she went upstairs, and I thought, that's alright. And I used to rack all my gear up on a CD case, and I racked a big one up, and I had one, and I had a couple of cans. Bearing in mind, she's gone 2 weeks over, and I hear her crying upstairs, Matt, my water's broke. And all I could think was, you selfish, you're spoiling my party. Can you get the car, Matt, and take me to the hospital? And I'm too pissed and too high. And she's got to phone her father up to come round and pick me up, because I'm a useless, no good waste of shit. That is why I am. I have not got the power to not do this. You know, on my own power, I'm drinking, I'm using, no matter what. Nothing will stop me. No water's broke. A copper at good, at best. A few coppers might stop me, or a couple of mushies. Nothing will stop me once I hit that first one, and that desire kicks in, and I can't control this allergy what's inside of me. You know, and we went to the hospital. She had him, and it was quite quick. I can remember lying in the bed, and my little boy Jude, he's in the bed next to me, 3 years old, big mop of curly hair, beautiful little boy, beautiful wife in the hospital with another little boy. And I'm sobbing, looking at this little boy sniffing cocaine, and I just can't stop. And I'm using against my will. and it's destroying me and it's eating me from the inside out. And everybody's coming down to make sure everything's all right. And I just can't bond with these kids. I just can't do nothing. Because alcohol and cocaine and Valium is king, not these people. Because they can't fix this stuff, what's going on inside of me. And what happened was, it carried on to that day, till 22nd of June 2010. And what happened was, me and her, it was over, it was done. And I come home after I've been in blackout on a Monday with a big bag of cans, and I walked through the door, and her dad was there, and she had a bag packed to ready to go and move. And he just looked at me and she said, "You're nothing but a drug addict and an alcoholic, Matt, and you absolutely disgust me." And I said, "Yeah, and you know what you are?" And I said that word to her again. And her dad looked at me, and her dad is about 9 stone piss wet free. And I said to him, "What the are you looking at? You know, this man who's done absolutely everything for me. You know, £25,000 wedding paid for. Didn't have to put fucking my hand in my pocket. Didn't have to do nothing. House there, ready to move into. Never had to do nothing. You know, help with the finances." And I went out on one of those benders to end all benders. You know, and I woke up in blackout, full of blood, in an old man's bed who I used to work with. And I woke up that next morning, and what happened was, I left the house where this man had been staying. I went back to my house, I picked up a bag, and the mother-in-law was there sobbing, saying, "Please don't do this, please go into treatment, please sort yourself out, please do what you've got to do. You've got 2 sons, Matthew, even if you and Lisa can't make this, do the best for them." And I'll never forget, she said, "The little one's in bed, he's upstairs," and it was a red hot day in the middle of June. And do you know when babies, when they lie down and they have the little nappies and they stick them up in the air, and he had his little bum up in the air like that. And I walked up to him and I stroked his head like he was a cat, and I said, "See you later, boy." And I was off. I found the only person in the world left who I had to ring. There was no friends for me to ring. There was nobody in Alcoholics Anonymous for me to ring. There was nobody. My sister, you know, God sends angels to me and people. And she was the only angel I had left at that point. You know, I had gotten a phone to her, and she got me a ticket from London Euston, and she had me up to Manchester Piccadilly. I remember walking, big bag of cans on the train. By some miracle, I still had a gram of gear left on me. I'm pinching on the train, I'm dismantling my phone, I'm putting it back in, because the British Transport Police, the FBI, the CIA, the Mafia, everybody's after me. In and out the train. And she's there, waiting. At the other end of the train, this angel is there, and she put her arms around me and she said, "I won't leave you." And she took me to my old drug and alcohol counsellors, you know, and it was mental. It was like a scene from Breaking Bad. 1 minute I'm in blackout in London, in Euston, looking at all the unsavouries there. The next minute I'm outside my old drug and alcohol counsellors in Rochdale, 4 hours later, 250 miles away. There's people stood outside this treatment place with their legs missing, street girls outside, scoring crack, looking for heroin, drinking fucking White Lightning. I'm looking at them thinking, "I wouldn't use you, none of you, look at the status. I ain't like you." And I went in, it was one of them national health places, and I buzzed in through that door. And a man who'd seen me, I think it was 8 years previous, called Johnny, was called, and he looked at me. And he said, "I've got cancellation if you want to come back in an hour. Try not to drink." "Okay, good luck with that one." So I've come back and I've bust in to this door, and he's gone in. And what happened was, he put me in and he sat me down, and it was the same room where I went for 6 months solid every Sunday. And he said, "I'm going to go and get your folder." And he come back and I'm having a little pinch as he's gone. And he's thrown his folder down on the table, and it's if he's got dust and cobwebs on it. And he's opened his folder up and he's gone, "Matthew, yeah, your wife's called Lisa, her mum and dad's called Robin and Mary, they blame you for everything, you're a drunk, you're a bully, you're aggressive, you're violent, you piss the bed, they treat Lisa like a princess, they believe her over you all the time, your mum's called Lynn, she's overbearing, your dad's called Billy, he loves your sister better than you, your sister tries to mollycoddle you, It's like my third column of my inventory. My third column of my inventory from fucking 8 years previous. And he looked at me and he said to me, "Do you have any codependents now and what need to go on this folder?" And I looked at him and said, "Do what?" He said, "Have you got any children's name what need to go on this folder?" And I had what can only be called as an internal fucking snap when resistance stopped and God stepped in, because there was nothing less more for me to do at this point, because I knew right there, right then, I could never stop for no one. And I fell off my chair and I broke and I sobbed and I sobbed and I sobbed, you know. And he said to me, "Come back next week, we'll crack on with the Reiki and the acupuncture." And I knew in my heart, I knew he was fucking lying to me. You know, "We'll try with the controlled drinking again." And I knew. And I was done. You know, my sister took me back to my mum's. I've not seen my mum for a long time. Long time. And my mum's looking at me. And I get that look, what only a mother can give. Do you know, they can't, nobody else can look at you like that. You know, and she's looking at me. And my dad, I class him as an hard drinker. He's had to go upstairs with his two bottles of wine and his four cans because he can't even look at me. And I've got a wife and a mother-in-law and a father-in-law and they're all on the farm. You know, page 18 talks about an alcoholic illness. And it touches the lives of the family sufferers like no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt. But not so with his illness. For there goes with it the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. Annihilation. Total fucking destruction. Like Hiroshima when it got that fucking bomb dropped on it. You know, it engulfs the lives of the sufferers. Covers them whole. You know, and this is what I've done before I've even got into recovery. Blameless children, despairing wives. Anyone can increase the list. And I'm back. And she's on the phone. This half, very, very mad Italian bird. And she said, "Get your fat northern whatever down back here. Me and you are done. There is no me and you no more. Them two boys need a father. You can sleep in that spare room. There is no me and you. I need you to come back here and pay this mortgage. You can go back to AA, you can go back to treatment, but I need you back here." And I went back and I did what any self-respecting junkie alky did. I found Frank, the old drugs helpline. And bless him, you know, he put me through to Cocaine Anonymous. And it's funny, I know we've got one or two of our Mickey Mouse friends in here, and it was a scouser on the other end of the hotline. And he was talking to me, you know, and we've got this thing inbred in us, these old fashioned belief systems. Mancunians and scousers, they don't talk, they hate each other. And this man sat on the phone on the other end of the outline and spoke to me for the remainder of the night and pointed me to a meeting. And I went to that meeting at Cocaine Anonymous on the 28th of June 2010, and the indescribably wonderful happened. I went to that meeting, and since that day I've not drunk, used cocaine, Valium, antidepressants, skunk, Librium or any other mind-altering substance. Because I went into that meeting, I had a packet of Valium in my pocket, and I heard something what I'd not heard before in them rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've been in South Woodford and other various places. That might work for them, that stuff. What I need is a power, and that power has got to be grounded in depth and weight. And that's what I heard in that meeting. You know, there was girls in there, and they was talking about how they'd had the children took away from them because they'd been working on the streets of King's Cross, and how they'd got the children back. There was men there with suits and shirts and ties, and they was announcing the self-recovered. You know, and I wanted a bit of this, what these men had. But I still had the stay away sign. You know, and, you know, they do the sponsorship announcement. I'd never seen that. And I'd see all these recovered alcoholics swarming around all the newcomers. "Oh, do you want me to take for the work? Da-da-da-da-da." None of them come near me. None of them. But come the Wednesday night, I went to a meeting in Chingford. And there's a man in there, John Brown. And he chased me out of the meeting and he said to me, "You look fucked." I said, "I am." And he took me, he said, "Get round my house Tuesday night next Tuesday. He gave me some Joe and Charlie CDs. Well, so that's what a man had. He told me to read the book, everything up to how it works, stop at that, and come round his house. And we went through steps 1, 2, and 3 very quick. But the thing what got me more than anything was how this man took me into his house. And he had 2 small children. And he had a wife who was in Al-Anon. And he introduced me to him. And I shook his children's hand. And his wife shook my hand. And all I can think is, I want to die. I want to kill someone. I want to top myself. I want to burn your house down. I want to burn everybody's house down. And this man showed me love, what I'd never felt before. He gave to me what he had. And we went through the work quick. You know, we wrote some inventory very, very quick. And we get to step 5. You know, wonderful step. The fucking step. You know, the stuff, what you can't tell and you can't write in inventory, but we can write it down. And I'll never forget, a man said to me, is there anything you can't get down on that paper you need to tell me? Or do you want to put it in an envelope and write it down and give it to me and I'll read it? And I won't tell him so. And he told me something what he'd done due to a phenomenon of craving. And he told me something what he'd done due to a mental obsession what made him then go and drink and use. The lie he believed into. And I told him. And every single 5th step I've ever heard from that point, it's always been sexual. Sometimes it's been innocent. Sometimes it's not. And mine was. And every single time, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, he used to go, do you remember that over the school playing field when you was 10? Do you remember? And he used to chatter and yap and yap and yap. And I used to get home from work and I'd have a few cans and I'd have a line of gear and that yapping stopped. Thank God for alcohol. It did for me what I could not do for myself, because I'd have been fucking long gone if I hadn't had a solution to my problem of that, because lack of power is my dynamo. And I told him this stuff. He gave me a list of defects, he gave me an amends list, and he said, get straight into 10, 11 and 12, 10 and 11. And all went well for a little while, and I did a few amends. Lisa and my wife, not having it, stay away from me, don't want to fucking know you, carry on sleeping in this spare bedroom. And I was so amazed before I was out through, I didn't bother with the rest of them. It was fantastic. You know, there's a promise. You'll be amazed before you was halfway through. Well, I don't have to do the rest now, it's fucking great. I don't have to go back and pay that money. It's brilliant. And what happened was, I started getting everything to sponsorship. People, I was helping them and they weren't getting it, and my ego was rebuilding like the Terminator, and they weren't getting it, and it was like, well, I'm fucking clean, I don't care, you know, putting my hands up, sponsoring people, and if I didn't get sponsoring, I'd be like, oh, heartbroken, devastated, and pick me, pick me. And it carried on and it carried on, and things was getting worse and worse with the wife again. Going into meetings, saying, hi, my name's Matt and I'm a recovered alcoholic. And I'm going home and I'm calling her that name again. 18 months into recovery, claiming I'm recovered, claiming spiritual progress, and I'm bullying the fucking life out of this girl who's took me back in the house again. You know, I'll never forget, you know, there's a man who sat in this room, you know, I was sponsoring an Asian fella at the time, and I'd never sponsored one before. And he was having a few problems with his wife, and after the first year, my sponsor said to me, he said, you don't need to ring me now with any serious, unless it's serious inventory, share it with your sponsees or share it with somebody you trust. And I thought, I'll have a look from my phone. And I thought, yeah, I'll go and share it with a little gamble. And I read this inventory out and I was resentful at this man. And the cause was he mistreats his wife and these belief systems, what he has, and, you know. And he said to me, can I just ask you something? He went, what? He said, what the fuck do you know about being a Muslim man? And I went, what? He went, who's your fucking sponsor? And I told him, he went, oh, yeah, I know him. He said, and his sponsors, yeah. And his sponsors, that geezer. And he's that geezer who got sponsored off that American who come over a few years. And he was sponsored off that, I forget what he's called, Clarence Snyder or whatever. And his sponsor was Dr. Bob. I went, yeah, that's right. He went, do you think you're fucking Dr. Bob? And I went, what? And he said, Dr. Bob, who had to work with 5,000 alcoholics until his death, do you think you're Dr. Bob, or do you think you're God and put the fucking phone down on us? And I was like, fucking hell, what's the matter here? And what happened? I started to unravel and unwind. And we went to Eurovision, me and the kids. Again, separate beds. And I'll never forget, we had a big Barney in the middle of Euro Disney. One of them where you see, and it's like something off the Jerry Mikhail show. You know, Jerry Springer, Mike. And we're arguing, and I'm like calling it that name in public. And I run off, and I broke, and I sobbed. And I shared it with a good friend of mine, Paul Dispine, over the back. And I rung him in there, and I broke, and I was fucking dying again. Sobbing, 18 months into recovery. Acting like an animal, but claiming I'm recovered. Is that how a recovered alcoholic behaves? Do you know what I mean? Is that the deal? And I'm treating her like this again. And all I can think of, well, she don't want me back, she must have another fella. And I'll never forget, she come home one night, and I was at, sorry, it was even in there. I said, when I get back, I said, see you, see them kids, you can all fuck off. And I'll move on, because I've got another little bird lined up in the meetings, and you can fuck off. I was 22 stone when I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Miracle sobriety. Lost 6 stone in weight, started looking dapper, started looking good. Little bit of attention off the females. Billy Big Bollocks, you know, going into meetings, brand new shirt on, brand new jacket, extra spray of Creed. Do you know what I mean? I'm thinking I'm some fucking hero. And I've said that to her. And I can remember a couple of nights later, she had all her friends down around the house, and she was sobbing downstairs to her friends, saying, I've put weight on. He's lost all this weight, and he's got girls interested in him in the meetings. And she was sobbing downstairs. I still couldn't see it. And something happened. You know, I get a lot of shit for this, but I'll tell you this. If you're the real one, because the end doesn't stop with the alcoholic, the phenomena of craving and the mental obsession. There's a few little dots in between. We admitted we were powered over alcohol, and there's some little dots. And the little dots mean end of one thought, beginning of another. And our lives have become unmanageable. And I started to hear voices in my mind. 18 months sober, away, the longest I've ever been from drink, cocaine or anything else. And I was fucked. And I sat in that little man's house over there the night after. And I sat down with him and his wife. And I said to him, you do that steel on steel, don't you? And he went, yeah. And I told him what I'd done. He said, do you seriously think you're in a fucking position to be living in the strict disciplines of steps 10 and 11? He said, you are absolutely fucked. And he said to me, have you ever been through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous? From the title page, line by line, page by page, chapter by chapter, step by step. I said, of course I have. He said, how long did it take to do it? I said, about 3 fucking days. He said, well, you're not going to be very thorough then, have you? And he said to me, why don't you pray for an open mind and a new experience and lay aside everything you've done with your recovery up to this point. So I got on the phone to my sponsor. I said, I don't want this little fucker to sponsor me. At the time, I said, I still want you to be my sponsor, John. He said, you'd be alright with Paul. You know, and he said to me, don't call me sponsor, I don't want to know that. That's not in the big book. He said, just I'm your friend, I'm your pal, and I'm here to help you. And we started on page 52. And he gave me a little notebook. He gave me a little notebook with personal relationships on one page, emotional nexus on another, misery on another, depression on another, fear on another, uselessness, couldn't make a living, and couldn't be of real help to other people. And he said, see that, go off for a week and don't pray. And every time you struggle with a personal relationship, write in that book. Every time an emotion comes, write it in that book. Every time misery comes, he said, you like a bit of inventory, fucking do that. And I went off for a month and I started, for a week, and I started unravelling again. And then we opened a big book at the doctor's opinion, looking at this physical allergy. And then we looked at the mental obsession, looking at Bill's story. Did I think like Bill? Did I drink like Bill? And did I feel like Bill? Did I feel like Bill in that bit of morass of self-pity? Was alcohol stretching out around me now again? And had I met my master? Because my unmanageability, my alcoholism, was taking me back to a mental obsession, and I was sinking. You know, looking at the jaywalker. Is this you, man? You know, looking at Fred, looking at Jim, and bringing that all into today, where I was at, and seeing the best statement in the book, lack of power. Do you lack power in these other areas, man? Because I just don't need power not to drink and not to use. I need a power, and it's got to be a power by which I can live. And that is my problem. And we looked at that and put a new conception of God together. One what I wanted to believe in. One what I could grow with prosperity. One what I could work with. One what I could trust. One what I could turn to. One that I would go to no matter what. Not one what was going to beat me. Not the one I'd heard when I was an altar boy. Not the one what my mum said, baby Jesus is watching. One personal to me. When Ebby went there to Bill and he said, why don't you choose a God, one personal to you? And that's what I did. You know, when looking at our proposition, is God everything or is he nothing? And what's that like looking in your life if you choose God to be everything? I can stay recovered. I could perhaps get things back with my wife. What's it looking like if he's nothing? There's no, he is or he isn't. Because he isn't anything anyway. God isn't a thing. I don't get down with God in the church. I'm sorry, you know, God's in here. Actually, we're fooling ourselves. Because the great reality is he's deep down within. That's where I found him. You know, when we looked at how it works and, you know, doing exercises around the ABCs, it's all bits and pieces what I fucking missed. You know, the big book's clear on it. If I'm not clear on the ABCs in the first ever printing of the big book, he says, if you're not convinced up to this point, rework the steps up to this point. If you're still not convinced, throw the book away. You might be wasting a better opportunity down the line. And then we look, because alcohol's now left the window, cocaine's now left the window, and now we're looking at the actor. You know, and am I convinced any life run on self-will can hardly be a success? You know, and he set the stages, man. Was he trying to arrange the lights, the scenes, the ballet? If all the players and all the tarmacers and all the sponsees and all the kids would only do as Matt wished, all would be well. But it just ain't working for me, you know. And he said to me, why don't you go and sit in some prayer and go and ask for some names and go and ask them where they see you running your life, selfish, self-centred, driven by a hundred forms of fear, self-pitying, stepping on people's toes, and why are they retaliating? Go and pray. He says in the book, we must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. Above everything, above inventory, above alcohol, above cocaine, above resentment, I must be rid of this, and only God can make that possible, and I need his help. And I go and I sit down and I pray for three names, and you know, I get my mother. And I go and she says, you just spend all that money and all that shit and all them clothes and this, that and the other and your fancy stuff and the kids are walking about in rags. I'm like, and he said to me, whatever she says, go on, go on the back and write it down. And I'm doing it. And I get my two little boys' names coming through strong. And they're like 8 and 5 at this point. And I'm going there, and I said, well, I can't ask him where I'm selfish. He said, just find the fucking words. You'll know what the words are. So I said, where am I mean? Where do I upset you? And where am I nasty to you? And my oldest boy, Jude, said, I don't like it when you call me Judith. I don't like it when you call me Judy. He said, and it upsets me sometimes when I go to bed. And I'm looking at him, and he said, but you make me nice dinners and you take me to nice places. And I love you, Dad. And I fucking broke. And I sobbed. And you know, this is the hour and the why of it. I've got to quit playing God. Do you know what I mean? In this drama of life. And am I going to have a new director? And a new employer? And being all powerful, will he give me what I need. You know, because I missed out on this decision. And I thought step three was just we get down on our knees and pray. You know, the decision is to turn selfishness and self-centeredness over to the Father of Light who presides over us all. Bill talks about it. You know, and how do you turn it over? Fearless moral inventory. You know, fearless. And this man showed me inventory like what I'd never seen before. Never. You know, we did some funny little tricks with it. None of this fucking half a dozen columns here and turn it over and writing some other shit on the back that I won't talk about because I'll get caned for that. It's not in the book, but I won't mention it. And we broke it down, praying the name for the list. And my boy's coming strong. And what's the cause with this with the boy? And I'm resentful at Jude. And the cause is he wants. More. Enough is never enough. Okay? So we opened it up. You know, the book says, how had it affected our self-esteem? So I turned it into a question. And it affected my self-esteem. He said, well, how is it? He said, I said, because it upsets me. He said, no. When you want, and he wants one of you, and you're going out working fucking 7 days a week, how's that affecting you? Because that's your money for your clubber. When he wants. He said, well, why? I said, I'm a good provider. That's who you are. It's a self-esteem. I'm a great provider. If that's my pride, Jude shouldn't want from me. If that's my ambition, I want Jude to respect me no matter what. If that's my security, I need Jude to worship me and honour me. Personal relationships, sons should love their father. Sex relations, Lisa might not have a turnout with me if I can't control him. Pocketbook, money affected. And this thing kept coming in, £475 a week. And he said to me, what's this £475 a week? I mean, that's the money I give her for the housekeeping. And everything's fitted in with this £475 a week. So the inventory's with her. She won't do what I think she should be doing with me. So that's going in as £475 a week. And then I see, we turn the page over, you know, and pray for these people. The most freeing words in that book. They, like ourselves, are sick to. You know, I'm praying for them. I'm praying for my little boy and dying inside. Because I'm the sick one. I'm the one who needs to get free. You know, where have I been selfish to Jude? You know, calling him names. Where have I been dishonest? Telling myself he doesn't love me. Where have I been self-seeking? I've smacked him and made him cry. And why am I frightened? I'm frightened he's going to turn out an alcoholic like me. And it absolutely fucking cut me to ribbons. To see this stuff, this turmoil, what I've been doing to this, my family. This woman who I'd left Manchester for in my life for. You know, and looking at the fears attached to this stuff. And it's all self-reliance. Every single bit, because I don't want to give it up. Everything, I don't want to give it to God. I can just keep this. Because if I can just keep this, she'll be alright. Still trying to run the show. You know, looking at boiling the fears down. And the only real fear I've got is being alone. That's the only fear I've got. Petrified of being alone. And writing sex inventory out. You know, like answering all the 9 questions. You know, what should I do instead with all this? You know, for a future sex ideal. And writing this future sex ideal. For myself, for a future life. And I've never seen this before. Something to grow to. What is it what you want in all areas of your life? Something we can work at. Something we can go to. And we see something. And I knew he'd done this. All I'd ever heard him was Paul was talking about these multiple step fives. And he used to frighten the fucking life out of me in the chairs, what he used to do. You know, the big book talks about we think well before we choose a person or persons with whom we share this private and confidential step with. You know, we usually find the solitary self-appraisal insufficient. Many of us thought it necessary that we go much further. You know, and he said to me, why don't you go and share that inventory with a female, right? He said, and another alcoholic or a cocaine addict. Right, and I went, and there was a couple in AA, multiple years worth of time behind them. And I went round and I sat in the house and shared this inventory out with them. And I shared this stuff about how I'd tortured the family and my wife. And I read this inventory and that word came out in the inventory again. And she looked at me this lady and she said, "Do you know something?" She'd see him and he sat there on the free piece. She said, "He's hit me, he's smothered me, he's took all my money off me before, he's left me for weeks on end and left me destitute." She said, "See that word? When he used to call me that word, that used to hurt me more than anything." And it was like somebody went like that, like fucking Zorro all over me. And you know what? I don't call my wife that word anymore. I don't call her that. Because that is what I got by seeking a spiritually fit female and discussing this stuff with her. You know, since I've been to a priest, I've been to a family member, shared it, the book talks about it. Perhaps it should be a family member. I'll tell you a cracker about a family member. I went with the family member and I got my brother-in-law's name. Paul said, "Take anything about your sister out of that inventory out and share the fucking lot with him." What, even a bit about the kids? Yeah. Even a bit about my mum and dad? Yeah. And I sat down and I shared this inventory and it was about the wife again. And oh, we ain't getting on. And I thought she was, I was doing a chair in Ilford and this phone goes, kids was away, there was up north at Manchester with my mum's, and it's a text message on the phone, Lisa. So the kids are away, how about you make us a nice dinner and I'll provide the afters. Now we're still going through this rocky period and I'm thinking, I'm in there, I'm going to go carry the message out to you and I'll get back and Mr. Lover Lover will come out. So I put, "Cheers, sweetheart, blah blah blah, I'll be there," and she's just ignored it. So I've got on, "Alright babe, yeah, what's that text message you sent me?" I thought, "Well, the kids are away." She said, "You can fuck off." I went, "Well, look at this text message, and it's on my phone underneath Lisa. Why don't you make us a nice dinner and I'll provide the desserts on my phone?" She said, "It's not on my fucking phone." And I'm like, "What?" And my nut is gone and I'm consumed. She's having an affair. She's doing it with a doctor on an helicopter, all that old bollocks. Just going round and doing me. And I get, and I share this inventory out with my brother-in-law. And his face goes white. And I went, "What's the matter?" He said, "I owe you one of these men." He said, "Why?" He said, "You know when Jude and Luke come up to your mum's every week?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, we had the kid's iPad, me and your sister, and we sent a message from the iPad." See, if I'd have not gone to this family member, I would have never got clear on her. I would have always had that nagging little thought, she'd been having an affair. But I got clear on it. I got clear on that shit. You know, step six, moving into that stuff. You know, there's only one defect ever gets removed, and that's selfishness, because every other fucking one's attached to it. The selfishness gets removed. I admit my shortcomings and I take that step seven. And I get given a list. 14 amends in Manchester, 10 in London. He said, "I'll give you 2 weeks to do the fucking lot." So I went out because I'm on an errand from God. I'm on a mission. Because I'm hearing voices in my fucking mind 6 months previous. I'm calling her all these horrible things and names and words and. And I get this list and I go back to the best man who had abused and threatened at my wedding, and I go back and I sit down with him, go back to my mum and dad, make a proper amends this time. And my mother said to me, "Please don't ever, ever make amends to me again. That stuff what you bring up hurts me too much. Your amends to me is please don't hurt me again." And I have to live by that. Do not hurt that woman who put her life on hold at 19 years old again. I still work to that today as a vision. The wife who had not accepted an amends up to the 2 years, I took her out to Manchester to the gay village. It's a big area. Took her out for a lovely bit of dinner, a big canal round there, loads of clubs, bought her a nice frock, bit of a Ted Baker number, treating myself to a shirt, a bit of money in my pocket, bought my mother a nice bottle of perfume, and I held her hand and I said, I want a process of here, life and death, and you've never wanted to accept an amends from me. Would it be possible now for me to sit down with you and frankly analyse the past? And she looked at me and she said, yes, I'm available for that now. And I looked at her and I get really clear on my harms. I've hit you, I've called you that name, I've stole money out of your purse, I've robbed your handbag, I've threatened your father, and everything else has come out. And she just looked at me. I said, is there anything else? She said, no. She said, other than you've ruined every single Christmas and birthday since the first year we met. She said, but I'll accept your amends because I can see you've changed. And I said, what is my amends to you? Now this girl, before she met me, was with another fella who's gone and made amends to him because I threatened him. And he'd always spoke to her, I mean, it sounds a bit twisted this, but they was going to get married, and he was going to get married in Vegas with Elvis, and she'd always wanted to do that. And she said, I'd like to renew my vows in Vegas. Now my mum had said to me 2 years previous, you and her, cock, she calls me, you ain't gonna make it. You need to save that money you were sticking on that shit up your nose, because you're going to need a flat, you're going to need a bedsit, because you're going to need to be a father to them boys, because you're from better stock than that. You've got more in your heart than that to leave them boys. She said, or prove me wrong and take them kids to Disneyland and prove me wrong. And this woman's saying, I want you to remarry her. So we went to Vegas on my 40th birthday party, you know, a fantastic barbecue, some fantastic friends who are in here now, round my house, all the family there, first sponsor, Paul, Kay, Paul, Fiona, Nikki, anybody else I haven't mentioned, you know, all in there. And we went to Vegas, and David get a pool party on my 40th birthday, safe and protected, and she's there and she's dancing away and she's just loving it, just drinking, just buzzing. And we went and we got married in the little chapel, remarried, and he picked us up in a pink Cadillac. And we drove down, and he's got the house, and he said, just get in the Cadillac. He said, everything will be alright. He said, you drive in, we'll start filming, and I'll sing to you. So he gets it. So he gets in, and he drives in through the doors, and we drive through, and he's got Viva Las Vegas on going on in the background. And we went in, and he pulled us out of the car, and he opened the door, and we walked out, and he said to me, Matthew, I want you to vision the day you very first laid eyes on this little lady. And I looked at this girl, and the girl I see stood in front of me was the girl from 1998 in Pasha in Ibiza, size 8 dress, like that, like a little doll. You know, she's had 2 kids by C-section, she's a little bit bigger now. Step 10 talking about entered the world of the spirit, because stood right there in front of me was the vision of God's will, not the vision of Matt Warwick's will, because God's will wasn't to leave me on that fucking park bench. God's will was to have me here with you tonight. God's will was to have me align myself back with my family. God's will for me is to be sober and safe and protected, and to help somebody else to be safe and protected. You know, and from that, you know, I remember we went back that night, me and her, in the hotel. She was absolutely blotter, out of her nut, drunk, was in the Venetian, beautiful hotel. And she looked at me, and she said, thank you so much. She said, you've made me feel like a young lady again. You know, and I'm there, and I can't buy this stuff. You know, this stuff is a limitless load which will carry on paying dividends as long as I carry on mining it and giving it a fucking way. You know, and what happened from that was I had one more amends, a big one. I've been sucking diesel out of my boss's vehicle for years. And he's the kind of man, in recovery and out recovery, I used to suck two cans out, about 50 quid's worth a week, for about 4 years. And it tasted disgusting, but it paid for me cocaine. And it used to have its hooks in me, and it was eating away at my spirit. And I couldn't go back and make amends, because people have gone back and make amends and they've been smashed up, because he's not the kind of bloke who made his money out of doing time at driveways. And my labourer had failed the drugs test, and he pulled me in the office and he said, Matt Lee's failed the drugs test, can you elaborate on this? Now, I don't give up no information, do you know? I'll leave puffs in the vans down to him, you know what I mean? But he's there, and he said to me, his blood pressure's through the roof, they took him to the hospital, he won't be coming back to work until he gets a clean bill of health, we'll help him. And he said, I remember you on the phone crying, and that was the 22nd of June 2010, telling him I went back to Manchester, telling her about the wife, how she doesn't love me. And he said to me, what happened to you? He says, because 5 years down the line, I don't see that bloke no more. And I sat, and what I do when I get anxious, I sit, I ask, what do you want from me, and what would you have me do right here, right now? And I asked, I said, is it now time? And the voice said, the time is now. And I said to this boss, I'm a recovered member of Alcoholics and Cocaine Anonymous, and I explained to him what we do. And it's a Friday night, 150 gypsies, Romanies, everybody else, all the monies are wrong, supervisor's trying to get the jobs ready, knocking on the door, and he gets up and the door gets locked with a clang. I think, oh shit. And then there's another door where the secretaries are, and that gets locked. And he sits down and he says, can you tell me about this stuff, what you do? And I've told him, and I told him about the amends process, and I said, I have a final amends, and that amends is to you. And he said, why is that? I said, well, for about 4 years I was sucking the living daylights out of your motor. And basically, how I didn't die, I don't know. But I'm here to put this stuff right. I've got £2,500 in the bank, and I need to pay you this back. Why do you need to pay me this back? He said. I said, because my life and lives of others depend on me paying this money back. And he looked at me and he said, I don't want your fucking money. And I said, you've got to take it. He said, get that money and go and take your children on holiday with it. Right? Now, I can't make this stuff up. And he's then got tears in his eyes. And he said to me, my daughter's in the priory at the minute. She's self-harming. There's people been cyberbullying her because she's been with a man, and they've put pictures here, there and everywhere, and they're calling her all these intolerable things, and she's cutting herself. And I can't do nothing for her. They just tell me to leave her. He said, it's killing me. It's breaking my heart. Do you think this stuff could work for her? You know. I said, I don't know. I said, but I know some good ladies who talk to her. You know, and I passed a couple of good ladies' phone numbers on. And he said to me, you can get me one of them big books and I'll have a look at it. Because there's a chapter in there to the employers. And I'm pretty sure he wants to know what the fuck's going on. And the best of it was, I know how I'm clear with that amends, because I had the cheek a fortnight previous to ask for a pay rise. And the pay rise is always got 10 a day, so it's 50 quid a week. And it's 2.5 grand a year. And I said to him, I don't want that pay rise. He said, you're having your fucking pay rise. I said, I'm not having it, I don't want it. He said, you're having your pay rise. Now, that pay rise never went in the bank, and I never asked for it. The amends is done. The amends is complete. I've gone through and completed all known amends. You know, and can look the world in the eye. You know, and with this, I'd love to say, and I will or it will, I'd love to say that that's the end of the journey. But it ain't. Because with that money, I take the kids to Disney, New York and Disney. You know, my wife, she booked. We knew we was going to Disney, like once in a lifetime thing for us. Worked hard for it, both of us, to take them there, give them the best of everything. And she books it, we know we're going to Disney. Christmas Day, get a present. New York for 4 days, Disney for 11 days. So we go, wonderful time, never been to New York. I had a look through Harlem, Mike. Not as bad as what they say, not having it. Moss side would piss all over it, that's all I can say. And, you know, we go and we have this holiday in Florida. Fucking amazing. Like a kid in Florida. And we get there on the last day and we had a connecting flight from Atlanta. And it was, we obviously flew from Orlando to Atlanta. It's a massive airport. I don't think I've ever been in an airport as big as that. And the kids are absolutely running wild in this terminal. And everyone's coming over, can you keep your kids in there? So we've chilled them out. And me and her are having catch up watching EastEnders because she's got a bit of Wi-Fi. And we sat there, and we're about 5 hours. We sat there. And there's a thing comes over for the flight, Virgin whatever to Heathrow. And we goes up to the front. And there's a lady there at the front. And it was when the Masters was on. The golf. And she said, we've overbooked the flight by 20 seats. Are you prepared to sit down with your family? She said, we'll put you up in a hotel in the airport. We'll give you £150 spending money each for the evening, and we'll give you 4 free return flights anywhere around the world for the next year. God just showed up again. 3-4 grand's worth of fucking flights. Guess where I've just come back from? I've just come back from Florida. You know, about 6 months ago, we got in a bit of financial trouble, me and the wife. You know, she's had new kitchens, I've had more new jackets, new driveway, new this, new that. Living not within our means. And she was after more money, and I'm giving her more money, and she's getting upset. Can we have this loan? Can we do that? And she said, I think we're going to have to go into debt management thing. And she's heartbroken. How have we got to this point? And she's been chasing this PPI for years. And she's chasing it and chasing it. And I went to my own group on the Wednesday night. And I come back. And we've got this cat. British blue cat, Oscar, is called. Absolutely hates me. Does not like me. Beautiful looking cat. Nikki loves him. And whenever he sees me through the glass, he goes. Whenever I go to stroke him in the morning when I make me coffee, he runs away. He hates me. He loves his mummy. And Oscar's looking at me all doughy eyed through the glass like that. I think, what's going on here? And I put my key through the door, and I'm banging on the window trying to wind him up, and he won't have it. And I put my key through the door, and I've gone in, and she's jumped up off the three piece, and she's gone, look at this. Look at this. I went, what? She went, look. There was £7,000 PPI, what she'd had there to pay the money for the spending money for this holiday, because we thought we couldn't go on it. And she said, there's another letter here. I said, what? She said, there's another one. I used to live in that house with Peter, the man who made the amends, said, for £2,800. And it's in my name. But on the deeds, it had Lisa and Peter. What do you think I should do with this money? I said, I don't think you need me to tell you what you need to do with that money, because it's not mine. The decision is yours. And she said, this is just too good to be true, isn't it? I've got to go and give him half of it. I said, I think you're right, sweetheart. Turns around, he comes in, Peter's in financial trouble. Will said, everything's connected. You know, are you connecting the dots? Or are you rubbing out the spaces? Because I don't know what you're doing. Don't know what I'm doing. I know what God's doing. He's giving me some good stuff. You know, the good stuff. You know, sponsorship. I sponsor 4 people in this room. There's about another 3 or 4 people in this room who they sponsor. You know, my sponsors in here. my grand sponsor's in here, Will's in here, you know, I'm part of something, part of life at last, you know, really, part of life at last, you know. I'll finish with this, you know, we went, coming back from Orlando, and we had to drive, because the flights had sold out, these free flights, and we had to get a car, we drove down to Miami, and we drive down to Miami, and we get in there, and we're in Miami Airport. Kids are running right again. And they're calling them up again, London Heathrow, and she's looking at me like that. She's looking at me, and the kids have gone, "Dad, Dad, go up and see that lady and ask her if they overbooked the flights again." And I've looked at the kids. I've looked at them. I've looked at her, and she's gone, "Go on, go on." And I've done what I always do. I turn inwards again. "God, what would you have me be here? Sit still and be calm. Stay. Because I don't know what I've got in store for you. I've got something else in store for you, but it's not this. You know, what's in store for you might be bigger, it might be better. It might be a death, it might be a birth. It might be life. But one thing I know, this is a goose what lays a golden egg, what will keep on giving and giving and giving. You know, how much are you willing to pay to have the destruction of selfishness and self-centeredness? You know, there is a way out. There is a solution, and we can recover." I'll leave it there.